I think this is our last shiur in the Aseret HaDibrot for now. Obviously, we'll come back to it in different ways. And again, all of us know that the first five are Bein Adam LaMakom, and the second five are Bein Adam LaChaveiro. And I think we were talking last week about the fact that Kibud of the Ein, which is seemingly an interpersonal mitzvah, is classified in the first five. And the one explanation I gave you was that the yisod of honoring our parents is to appreciate the gifts of life. And as a result, if one appreciates life, one ultimately appreciates Hashem who gave us life. And therefore, Kibud of the Ein is the Pesach, is the opening, the enabler to honor Hashem and to love Hashem, because it teaches a person Hakaras HaTov. I think I mentioned before that the idea of Hakaras HaTov is so fundamental that that is the very definition of the word Jew, Yehudi. If you check some of the dictionaries, they'll tell you Jew means a cheapskate, but that's an issue in the United States in terms of Southern slang. But Jew, actually, Yehudi, means the person who is grateful. Leah called her fourth son Yehuda. Okay. Well, I'm not going to repeat everything, but basically the concept is that we mentioned last week, and I just want to elaborate on a little bit, that even though the first five commandments are supposed to be Bein Adam LaMakom, between man and God, and the fifth commandment, honoring your parents, seems to be connected to interpersonal, but it is also connected to loving God and honoring God, because if we honor our parents out of gratitude because they gave us life, so we cherish life. If we cherish life, we ultimately honor the ultimate source of life, which is Hashem. And thus, Kibud Av V'Em is a Pesach, is an enabler for us to honor Hashem and to love Hashem and to revere Hashem for the great gift of life that He gave us. The very term Jew, which is Yehudi, is connected to gratitude. Leah called her fourth child Yehuda because she said, "Hapam Odes Hashem, I am now grateful to Hashem." Rashi explains that Leah knew with Ruach HaKodesh that there would be 12 Shevatim. She knows there are four wives, Leah, Rachel, Bilhah, and Zilpah. Each one of them gets three. 12 divided by 4 is 3. When she got more than was coming to her, that gave her the feeling of gratitude of Hakaras HaTov. Hakaras HaTov is when we recognize Hashem has given us more than we deserve. And the Sfas Emes says, every Jew is called a Yehudi because every Jew must go through life with the recognition that Hashem has given me more than I deserve. So the definition of a Yehudi is he who is grateful. He who understands that life is a gift. He who understands that no matter how difficult things might sometimes be, Hashem is giving us gifts every single second. That is the meaning of a Jew, a grateful person, an aware person. Even the word for gratitude is evocative, because Hakaras HaTov really does not mean gratitude. Hakaras HaTov means recognizing the good, because that is the first step. Thankfulness comes out of recognition. Most of the time, it's not that we're ungrateful. Most of the time, we didn't even notice. Hakaras HaTov says, be watchful, be observant, notice. Notice the things that people do for you. And above all, notice the chesed that Hashem shows us every single second. That is why the Svarim tell us, and this is a little bit nogea to Shavuos, that of all of the nations that are excluded from Klal Yisrael, even Amalek that we're supposed to destroy, if an Amaleki converts L'Shem Shemayim, we accept them. That's pretty amazing. An Amalekite can convert into Am Yisrael and be accepted if it's L'Shem Shemayim. That's why the Gemara says, the descendants of Haman became Talmidei Chachamim. But the one nation that is not given the option of converting and being accepted to Klal Yisrael, at least on the male side, is the nation of Ammon, or the nations of Ammon and Moab. The females can do it, that's Rus. But the males cannot. Now, the Chaira, what did the males do that was so bad? They didn't hurt us, they didn't kill us, they didn't give us water. It was a sin of omission, much less than Amalek. But the commentaries say that because Ammon and Moab are descended from Lot, and Avraham did so much chesed for Lot, the midah of Ammon and Moab is kafoy tova, not to be grateful for chesed. Amalek was evil, but Amalek was rejected by us. Or at least the Timnah, the mother of Amalek, was rejected by us. So their evil comes out of rejection. But Ammon and Moab's evil comes out of kafui tova. And hakarat hatov is so fundamental that the midah of kafui tova has no place, no admission into Klal Yisrael. The Rabbi Avigdor Miller Zatzal used to talk about hakarat hatov a lot. This was one of his themes over 70 years of teaching Torah. And it was based on the Chovas HaLevavos, and I think we talked about it a lot. I think I told you the story about his head was, he once submerged his head in a sink full of water. And his granddaughter came, and she didn't know what was happening, and she pulled him out. And he said, I was going to come out. I was going to count to 10 and come out. And so Zadie, why was your head in the water? He said, I was walking in Flatbush that day with somebody, and they remarked that the air was polluted and the air wasn't good. And I felt bad because that took away some of my hakaras hatov for the ability to breathe. So I wanted to put my head in an environment where I couldn't breathe at all. And after I took my head out, I realized the air wasn't as bad as I thought. Again, for sure, do not try this at home. You know, it is actually dangerous, certainly if no one else is around. But be it as it may, this is how important the idea of Hakaras HaTov was to him, that he wanted to experience the gift of breathing, the gift of walking. This is what a bracha is, a bracha on going to the bathroom. I mean, all of these brachos, to express gratitude for what Hashem gives us. And that is why Kibud Aviyim, which is the Yesod is gratitude, is put on Bein Adam LaMakom, because without gratitude, you can't have a relationship with God. But there's another reason why Kibud Aviyim is put in the first five. And this is a very important message for all parents to think about. And that is, a child's relationship to Hashem is based on how they perceive a parent. A child can perceive a parent in many different ways. In an ideal way, the child can look at a parent as a source of security, reliability, love. I can depend on my parents. And then he can understand that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is super parent, even more so. But if a child views a parent as cruel, unpredictable, arbitrary, ever-changing, then that is how the child is going to view Hashem. Now, can a person grow out of that? A person can grow out of it, of course. We can all become mature, we can have deeper insights, but it's not as easy as it sounds. In many, many ways, our image of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is formed at a very, very young age. And therefore, parents are the architects in how the child views the Ribono Shel Olam. So there are two different reasons why Kibud Aviyim is in the first group of five. One is, from Kibud Aviyim, we appreciate life, and therefore we honor Hashem. And number two, the ability to connect to Hashem is very much connected to how we view our parents. Our parents form within our psyches our image of HaKadosh Baruch. We now come to the second five. Now the second five are much shorter, and let me remind you, I think the first or second week, I shared with you the thought of the Mabit, just to repeat it very quickly. The Mabit points out that there are many more words in the first five than in the second five. Right? The second five are short, are staccato, and yet they took up the same amount of space, surface area, on the Luchos. So the Mabit says, in order for a smaller number of words to take up the same amount of area, the letters of the Bein Adam L'Chaveiro must have been much larger than the letters Bein Adam L'Makom. So when Moshe Rabbeinu comes down with the Luchos, and they got broken before they came down to us, but we see them from the mountain and we put on our glasses and try to see what they say, the first thing we're going to see is the Bein Adam L'Chaveira instead of the Bein Adam L'Makom. And that reminds us how important Bein Adam L'Chaveira is. Sometimes we make a very big mistake where we identify the meaning of being a religious Jew as primarily the Bein Adam L'Makom, the Shabbos, the Kashrus, as important as they are. Bein Adam L'Chaveira, that's just being a good person. But no, you see, it is the essence of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it's a very, very big avla that sometimes when people think of being machmir in halacha, I want to be stricter, I want to be more observant, I want to do more, people almost always think of Bein Adam L'Makom. Baruch Hashem, I have to say, I think women are actually less prone to this. Maybe I'm speaking more from the perspective of men. Baruch Hashem, I think women have brought to Klal Yisrael a greater sensitivity to interpersonal relationships, and that's something that we men have to learn from as well. But at least in the yeshiva world, the gut reflexive reaction to being stricter in Judaism is almost always something connected to Bein Adam L'Makom and not necessarily Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. And the Mabit, who lived in the time of Rav Yosef Karo, teaches us how important this is. Now, Bekitzur, another point I want to share with you very briefly is that if you line up the Dibros 5-5, you can actually see a correspondence between each Dibor in each column. In other words, the first commandment corresponds to number 6, the second commandment corresponds to number 7, the third commandment corresponds to number 8, the fourth commandment corresponds to number 9, and the fifth commandment corresponds to number 10. Okay, it's Zel Yumaseh, and I just want to briefly go over why that would be so. The first commandment, which is really a statement, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Mitzrayim, that is the commandment to believe and to understand there is one supreme God, to believe in God, not chas v'shalom, to deny God's existence, to know there's a God. Commandment number 6 is lo tirtzach, do not murder. Right, that is the great, right, many people have pointed out, the standard translation, do not kill, is not entirely accurate, because sometimes the Torah says you have to kill people. You kill, for example, someone that has been sentenced by a Beis Din to the death, although we don't have that today. You're supposed to kill a rodef, somebody who is threatening someone else's life. And that even includes abortion. If, God forbid, an unborn baby is threatening the mother's life, Maimonides, the Rambam Paskins, that there's a mitzvah to abort the child in order to save the mother's life, because although the child does not have malevolent kavana, the child is halachically a rodef. There were even cases where after a child was born, if a family was in hiding during the Holocaust, and the baby started crying and would endanger the lives of 10 people, according to halacha, you'd be allowed to kill the baby. So that is why people have pointed out that the more accurate translation is not killing, because the Hebrew word for killing is laharog, and laharog does not have a moral condemnation. Laharog includes rightful killing, wrongful killing, but the correct word is ritzicha, always refers to killing that does not have justification, and therefore murder. So murder correlates with denying the existence of God, because a human being is created in the image of Hashem. In the human personality is the godliness of the soul, the wisdom, the autonomy, the bechira, the creativity. And when you destroy a human being, you are trying to destroy an aspect of godliness in the world. It is as if, as it were, kavyachol. You can't really say it that way, but you are destroying an aspect of God's revelation, and therefore you are denying God's existence, and therefore aneichi and lo tirtzach are connected that way. The Gemara even gives a very amazing metaphor, which we would never say if the Gemara didn't say it. You know, there's a din that when somebody is executed, by the Beis Din, you hang his body up so people will see that he was executed for his sin, but you must bury him before sunset. And the Torah says in Kisetze, Ki kilalas Elokim talui, To leave a human body hung up in the open is a curse of God, curse to God. That's what it says. And therefore, you have to bury him. So the Gemara gives this example. It's an amazing example. Imagine a king that had a twin brother that was an identical twin. But it was good twin, bad twin. And the bad twin was a criminal who was executed. And you hang up the body of the bad twin. And every time people walk by the body of the bad twin, they think about the king being hung up. And therefore, because they look the same. Now, obviously, Chazal do not mean to suggest at all in any way that physically a human being looks like God. God has no form. That's one of our fundamental principles, and the Torah itself says it. But it means in terms of character, midos, personality, bechira, intelligence, we are an infinitesimally small reflection of the divine, and therefore murder is treated as a destruction of an aspect of divinity, which is a violation of Anochi Hashem Elokecha. So that's the correlation between Anochi and Lo Sirtzach. Now the next prohibition, again, these are going to be very quick, they're relatively short, and there's not a lot of commentary I have on them, is Lo Tinaf. Do not commit adultery. This is the halacha that says when one is in a marriage, one must be faithful to one spouse. One cannot commit adultery. Now again, there's a bit of an inconsistency here in some ways, and that is if a married man lives with an unmarried woman, technically he's not guilty of adultery. But the reason that's so is because the Torah permits polygamy. So you can't accuse the man of violating his commitment to his wife, because under Torah law he's allowed to have more than one wife. Now, after the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom, which Ashkenazim observed since the 11th century, that might be different, but the Torah could not possibly consider a married man with a single woman as committing adultery because he's allowed to marry her. But if the woman is married, that is considered to be adultery, and that's a very, very serious offense. If she did it intentionally, she cannot even go back to her husband, and any child that she has is technically a mamzer. So adultery is a betrayal of a marriage relationship by not recognizing the exclusivity of the relationship. What is the second commandment? You shall not believe in any other gods beside me. The second commandment is not simply saying believe in God, but even if you believe in God, but you believe there are many gods, you believe there are other gods, you believe that God has entrusted the world to subordinate forces. So what you're doing is you're unfaithful to your marriage, to Hashem. Now this is an imagery that appears over and over again to the Nevi'im, where the Jewish people, Hosea in particular, the Jewish people, in fact we read it in the Haftarah this past week, the Jewish people are like Hashem's wife. And when we wander and we worship Avodah Zarah, we are unfaithful to our husband. We are committing adultery. And therefore there's a direct correlation. Thou shalt not have any other gods. Don't commit adultery. Stay faithful to your marriage commitment. In fact, Matan Torah is described in many Makoros as a marriage. Many of the minhagim of a chuppah, the candles that the parents carry, are based on the fact that at Matan Torah, which was a marriage, there were kolot, right? There was thunder and lightning and fire, because Matan Torah is a chasna. Svardim have the custom that instead of akdamos, which we read, Ashkenazim read, they actually read a kesuva. It's very interesting. They have a kesuva, a marriage contract where Hashem is the chasan and Bnei Yisrael is the kala. But when we worship other gods, even if we believe in Hashem, we are committing adultery. Right? So that's the correlation between the second commandment, Lo Yielecha Elohim Acherim, and Lo Tinaf. Now, the third commandment, I'm sorry, the seventh commandment, is Lo... I'm sorry, the eighth commandment, yes. Yes, six, seven, eight, right. The eighth commandment is Lo Signov, do not steal. And here, of course, we know Rashi's very important comments from the Medrash, that lo tignov is not referring to the stealing of money, because stealing of money has another pasuk in the Torah, in Parshas Kedoshim, which is lo tignovu. And Rashi says that all of the dibros here, since it says don't kill and don't commit adultery, those are capital offenses. So lo signov cannot mean don't steal money, because that's not a capital offense. You don't get, right? So it has to be a type of stealing for which a person would be chayav misa, and that is kidnapping. Kidnapping is an aveira for which the Torah says you are chayav misa. By the way, I do want to point out that a parent cannot commit kidnapping on a minor son. So when you have custody battles, unfortunately, I'm not condoning anything illegal. And a father, let's say, they call it kidnapping, you know, takes a child, whatever, that is not kidnapping because that's a parent. But if someone else takes a child or even an adult, and usually in the ancient world, it was not to have a child, it was to sell them as a slave, that would be a chiyuv misa. Now, so kidnapping is wrongfully taking that which should belong in a different environment. Now, the third commandment is not taking God's name in vain, and that refers specifically to swearing falsely in the name of Hashem. Now, Hashem's name is Hashem's property. And when you use Hashem's name to affirm the truth, that's actually a mitzvah. The Rambam actually paskins, it is a mitzvah to swear truthfully in God's name, because then you're basically saying God is the ultimate source of truth. But when you take God's name, which is the essence of truth, and you misappropriate it for lies, there is an aspect of kidnapping here. You're taking God's attributes and you're using it in a perverse, improper way. So in effect, taking God's name in vain is a form of kidnapping by appropriating the midah of truth of Hashem and using it for falsity, using it for lying. Right, so that's the connection between number 3 and number 8. Now, number 9 is do not engage in false testimony. And this is an iser d'oraisa, to commit what we would call perjury. When you're in front of, even if you didn't swear, even if you didn't take an oath, if you testify in a beis din or a court and you testify falsely, you transgress the negative commandments of leisana bereyacha eid shoker. Now, interestingly enough, there's a whole parsha in the Torah. Let's say two witnesses testify that Reuven killed Shimon. Right? They testify Reuven killed Shimon, and as a result, the Sanhedrin sentenced Reuven to death. Let's say two other witnesses show up, and they say, before Reuven is killed, how could you have seen Reuven kill Shimon? Because they have to give the time and place. On Monday, 10 a.m. in Chicago, on Monday, 10 a.m. that day, you were with me in New York. You couldn't have seen what you've seen. So you know what the Torah says? An amazing thing. The Torah says that the first pair of witnesses have become discredited. They have been established as liars. And what you do to the first witnesses is the punishment that they wanted to impose on Reuven. They wanted to impose. They wanted to get Reuven killed. We do to them what they wanted to do. They get killed. And the same thing is true for lesser punishments. If they testify on whatever it is, Rosh Chodesh Iyar in Chicago, Reuven borrowed $100 and owes Shimon that money, and the witnesses become discredited in that way, they have to pay. It's a punitive fine. They have to pay Reuven $100. If they testified Reuven committed a sin for which he would get lashes, and they get discredited, they get lashes. Okay, whatever it is. Death, money, lashes. This is called v'asisem lo. You shall do to him, meaning the discredited witness, kasher zaman lasos liachiv, as they tried to do to his brother. Whatever they tried to do, this is the punishment you give them. Now, the term for discredited witnesses is Edim Zomimim. Edim Zomimim means witnesses who have been proven false. But here, there's a very interesting halacha. I'm just going to mention it. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. And that is, the Gemara has a drasha. And the drasha is very counterintuitive. The drasha says, since the pasuk says, you shall do to the witnesses what they tried to do to their brother, we infer they are only punished for what they tried to do. They are not punished for what they actually did. Now, what this means is the following. Imagine this case, and this is going to make no sense at all when you hear it. Two witnesses testify, Reuven killed Shimon on a certain date. Reuven gets executed. After Reuven gets executed, two other witnesses show up and say, how could they have said that? They were with us in Chicago. What happens to the first witnesses? Nothing. They go home. Because after all, it's no longer what they tried to do, it's what they did. Now, if they get caught before Reuven gets killed, we kill them. If they get caught after Reuven gets killed, we don't kill them. And the basis of this is a drasha, what they tried to do, and not what they did. What's the logic of it? So Ramban offers a bit of an explanation. The Ramban says the following. You might really ask a question. Why should you ever believe, in other words, why should you ever discredit witnesses? Who says the second people are telling the truth, right? In other words, the first people say Reuven killed Shimon. Second people say, you were with us in New York. Maybe they're lying. So the answer is that the Torah says you believe the second one. That's true. But, the concept is Hashem would not allow the Sanhedrin to execute an innocent person. So if the second group does not show up until after Reuven was killed, that is a siman min hashamayim, that Reuven was chayav misa, the first witnesses were telling the truth, and the second witnesses were not. So it all depends. If Hashem nips it in the bud, Hashem is showing you that the first ones are no good. But when Hashem allows the process to be completed, that is a divine sign. Now that wouldn't apply to a secular court necessarily, but at least for a Beis Din, God will guide their deliberations so they will not allow an innocent man to die. Okay, now, how is that, all right, so that's number nine. How is number nine correlated with number four, which of course is Shabbos? Very, very simple. What is Shabbos about? We are giving testimony that Hashem is the creator of the world. When you violate Shabbos, you are giving false testimony. You are testifying that you don't believe that God is the creator of the world. Says commandment number nine, don't give false testimony, give true testimony. Shabbos is considered to be edus. In fact, this is why some people are machmir, not everybody is. You know, after the Amida of Maariv, so in Shul we say the paragraph Vayechulu Hashemayim Va'aretz, that God made the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh day. So maybe you've noticed this, that many men will, if they didn't finish Shemon Esrei till after the congregation said it, they will look for another person to say Vayechulu with. I don't know if you've ever noticed this. And the reason is because since they're giving testimony, and testimony normally requires two people, they will look for another person so they can say it as a unit of two. Now the Chazon Ish said you don't have to do that. I don't do that myself, but some people are machmir to look for two people or another person. But be it as it may, whether you need two or not, Vayechulu is considered to be giving testimony. Keeping Shabbos is giving testimony. And therefore, it corresponds to the ninth commandment, don't give false testimony, which you're doing by keeping Shabbos. Okay, we now come to commandment number 10, which actually Of all of the list, of all of the last five, commandment number 10 is actually the most difficult to precisely explain. Not murder, not commit adultery, not kidnap, and not give false testimony are fairly self-explanatory commandments. They don't have a lot of complication in terms of their basic definition. But number 10 is actually a bit difficult to explain. Lo sachmod, do not covet. Covet means do not desire other people's property, whether it's their wife, their property, their house, whatever it is. I don't mean to say property. No, don't covet that which someone else has in life. And of course, the question becomes, what exactly is being prohibited here? Now, here, by the way, there is one major difference in the Dibros in Yisro and in their reiteration in V'yaschanan. A different verb is used. In Yisro, lo tachmot, do not covet. In V'yaschanan, it says, lo tisaveh, do not lust. And this may be a case where the two Dibros actually have a different halachic meaning. First, let me explain lo sachmot. Many Mefarshim, including the Rambam, actually say that if I'm simply jealous of somebody, you know, I wish I had their car, I wish I had their house, I wish I had their job, that's a very bad midah. Jealousy is a bad midah. But technically, I have not transgressed lo sachmot. According to the Rambam, I don't transgress coveting until I try to pressure you to give it to me, even sell it to me, if you don't want to. So an example would be the following. Let's say you have a very beautiful painting that I really want. So if I'm simply jealous that you have it, and it's just in my heart, that's a very bad midah, to be sure. It's the opposite of sameach b'chelko, to be grateful for what you have. It's the opposite of hakaras hatov. But technically, as a technical matter, you have not transgressed lo sachmot. If I ask you if you would sell it to me, that's also lo sachmot. I'm sorry, I haven't transgressed yet. But if I ask you to sell it to me and you say no, and I keep on bothering you and bothering you and bothering you, and you eventually sell it to me, even though I didn't steal it, you sold it to me, I have transgressed lo sachmot, because I have put pressure on you to give up something that's rightfully yours that you really didn't want to give up. So according to the Rambam, the love of lo sachmot does not refer to what is called chimud belev, simply coveting in your heart. It refers to putting pressure on people to give up something they don't really want to give up, even if you pay them for it at the end. Okay, so that's an important idea. On the other end, I want to say that some Mefarshim say that even if lo sachmot does not cover the feeling of your heart, lo tisaveh might. So in effect, you know, you're out of the fire, you're out of the frying pan into the fire, because it almost makes no difference. Lo sachmot may refer to the action of forcing someone to give you something. Lo tisaveh refers to the jealousy of the impulse. But be it as it may, the common denominator is that one has to understand. Again, there's a famous Ibn Ezra comment. The Ibn Ezra apparently differs with the Rambam. The Ibn Ezra apparently learns that lo sachmot is the feeling of jealousy that's in you, and the Ibn Ezra asks the question, how could God command the feeling? Now the Rambam's answer would be, God didn't asser the feeling, God assered acting upon it. That's the Rambam's answer. But the Ibn Ezra apparently understands that Hashem is assering the feeling itself. How is it possible? So the Ibn Ezra gives a very famous mashal about a kafri. Kafri is a villager that sees a royal procession of a queen with all of her wealth. The kafri will have no lust or desire for that, because he understands that he's so far removed from having any connection to that he literally will not have the desire. We only have the desire for something that we think is within the realm of our possibility. So the Ibn Ezra says, a Jew has to understand that everything that Hashem has given us in the world, every person gets exactly what is magia lahem. And therefore, I should look at somebody else's property as if they're like a melech,
and it has no connection to me, and they should look at mine in the same way, right? One reaches that that madrega. Now, what is the connection between Lo Sachmot and Kibud Aviyem? It's now an obvious connection. When I have chemda, I am not happy with the life that Hashem gave me. I want more, I want different, I want something else. But Kibud Aviyem is exactly the opposite. Kibud Aviyem comes from a gratitude for the existence that I have. If a person has gratitude for the life that Hashem gave them, then there's nothing to covet with the other person. Elamai, if I covet, I don't appreciate what I have. If I don't appreciate what I have, I will not have Kibud Aviyem for my parents, right? So the point basically is that each of the first five does have at least some connection to the second five. You know the old story that they tell? I don't think it's a medrash. I think it's like a Yiddish folk story, but it expresses the truth about if each person were able to, let's say all the tzaras of the world, everybody put down their tzaras in a common place, and you can put down your tzaras and choose other people's lives. If you looked around, you would always wind up choosing the life that Hashem gave you. I'd rather have mine than somebody else's. And in many, many ways, what Hashem gives us is tailor-made for the struggles that we need to go through. Now, we don't understand this always, but each neshama comes into the world with a different mission, a different set of responsibilities, a different aspect that has to be fixed. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us the life that is bidiyuk, what we need for our particular tikkun. And as they say, anyone else's life would not be matim, would not really fit the process that we need to go through. Yeah. Yeah.
And then at the bottom, it would seem that the hardest goal would be to work on something that, according to some, has an aspect of just the way you feel.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's no question. I mean, you're 100% correct. And as a general proposition, Lo Sachmot is certainly a harder mitzvah to do than don't kill. And once again, adultery. You know, there are people in the secular world that say, hey, adultery is okay because it's a victimless crime. So they argue, if both parties won. And of course, obviously it isn't. So yeah, I think there is a notion of spiritual growth, meaning to say you start with the most basic, but then as you grow in your spiritual levels, you eventually reach the idea of understanding your life is what your life has to be, and you don't covet other people's existence. Yeah. Right.
And so then you don't have to cross the toes of Hashem's garment. So each thing that you do is not just personal on your own, but impacts your relationship with Hashem's garment in a circular fashion. So one pushes the other. One
right.
rolls onto the other. So it's a constant circular, and one impacts the other. So it's a whole.
Right. No, that's exactly right. And it goes back to the beginning of what we talked about, and that is, without Hakaras HaTov, there can be no relationship with God. And coveting is exactly the opposite of Hakaras HaTov. Coveting basically says, my life isn't good. I like somebody else's life more than mine. And that is a whole negation of Hakaras HaTov. I remember reading years ago one of those little stories in Reader's Digest. About, there's one of those stories, I don't remember all the details, but it was about a person that towards the end of his life is like, you know, he had certain dreams that he would have a certain type of marriage and he would have certain types of children, and instead, you know, nothing was exactly the way he expected, and he has God coming to him, and God's basically saying, gee, I'm sorry you feel that way, I gave you one of my nicest packages, you know, it described the idea, you know, that old mashal that actually came out of a woman with an autistic child. She once gave a beautiful, it's a very, very famous story about having a special needs child, she said, was like buying a ticket for Italy, and by accident they sent you to Holland's. And Holland is a very charming country and a very beautiful country, but because your mind is always on Italy, you don't see the beauties that are in front of your eyes because you're so fixated on the other thing. And that's where Hakara Satov, right? So she says that you have to, you know, it's not Italy, and that's a shock to your system because you expected something. But if you sit back and think and look, you will see the beauties in what Hashem has given you as well. And that's why Lo Sachmeid is a very, very destructive thing. Because Lo Sachmeid is not only evil because we're hurting somebody else, as the Rambam would say, but it's also an evil because we never see the world that Hashem has given us. And that's such a tragedy. We have the beauty right in front of us, and we're looking at something else the whole time. Now, one interesting thing, in Avos de Rabbi Nassan is a braisa on Pirkei Avos. It's like an elaboration of Pirkei Avos. It's much bigger than Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos is only 6 prakim, and Avos de Rabbi Nassan is like 35 prakim, so it's a big elaboration. So it mentions on the Mishnah, Ezeyo Ashir, who is wealthy? Hasomeach b'chelko, he who is happy with his lot. And by the way, this is just such a fundamental truth. I mean, you really, you know, you see this every single day, that is really what happiness is. It's not a pashut, you know, it's not just a maimer chazal. But Avos de Rabbi Nassan says, why do you have to be sameach b'chelko? Because you have to emulate the midos of Hashem. Just like Hashem is sameach b'chelko, you should be sameach b'chelko. So this is a very, very strange statement. Well, Hashem has everything. Yeah, of course Hashem is happy with his chelek because he's not missing anything. What does it mean, Hashem is sameach b'chelko? And what is chelko anyway? So the Mefarshim say very beautifully that sameach b'chelko, it says in Hazinu, ki chelek Hashem amo. Hashem's chelek, Hashem's portion, is Am Yisrael. Sameach b'chelko means Hashem gets nachas and pleasure from Am Yisrael, even though we're not so perfect all the time. And therefore, that's the idea. Hashem is also sameach b'chelko. Meaning, it's a strange thing to say. Hashem also doesn't have it perfect, because we're not perfect. Right? He's stuck with us. We're not perfect. But Hashem has simcha in us. And therefore we too have to have simcha even in the world that we think is not as perfect as we would like it to be. Another thing Avos de Rabbi Nassan says, which is not Nogea today, but it's a beautiful thought just to be mamshech. Another way we emulate Hashem is just like Hashem judges people l'kaf sechus, he judges people favorably, we should judge Hashem we should judge other people favorably, right? So Hashem is sameach b'chelko, we are sameach b'chelko. Hashem is dan kol adam l'kaf sechus, we should judge kol adam l'kaf sechus. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz used to ask, that too doesn't make sense. Judging people l'kaf sechus means, as we say in English, giving people the benefit of the doubt. So if I see you going into a McDonald's, I'm mechuyev to assume that you're using the bathroom or you want a glass of water. I give you the benefit of the doubt, like Revitz and Samet's book, The Other Side of the Story, whatever, right? You never know. But with Hashem, that makes no sense. If I go into a McDonald's, Hashem knows why I'm going in. What does it mean, Hashem gives me the benefit of the doubt? There is no doubt. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz used to explain that judging people l'kaf sechus is much more than giving people the benefit of the doubt. It also means that, but it goes beyond it. And that is, ever since the eating of the fruit of the Eitz Hadas, which is the mixture of good and evil, every single human activity is a mixture of good and evil. There is good in our bad, and there is bad in our good. What do I mean? I do good. I daven. I give tzedakah. I do mitzvahs. I do chesed. It's good. But in my good, There's an aspect, I might be doing it for arrogance, for gaiva, for ego, not l'shem shamayim. So in my good, there is a taint of something that's bad. And in my bad, I lost my temper, I was harsh. There is what you might call at least a mitigating circumstance. Meaning, I had a very rough day, things were difficult, I had pressures. Meaning to say, in my good there are negatives, and in my bad there are at least mitigating circumstances. Judging l'kaf sechus, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, doesn't mean giving people benefit of the doubt, which is naivete. But it means, given the reality that in the good there is bad and in the bad there is good, what do you choose to focus on in looking at somebody else's actions? Do you choose to focus on the good within their actions? Or do you choose to focus on the negative? Right? If your 8-year-old decided to wash the dishes for you and as a result broke 5 plates, and you come home, whatever it is, and you see 5 plates broken, right? What do you look at? Do you look at the broken plates? Or do you look at the fact that this little child wanted to do something for Abba and Ima? And this could be magnified to, you know, Abba breaking the plates too. Whatever it might be. So you see what Chaim Shulevitz is saying. So that's what Hashem does. Hashem in his rachamim will focus on the goodness within us, and the mida keneged mida is when we focus on the goodness within us, within the other, Hashem will focus on the goodness within us. So you see, it's very different than judge. If it's giving people the doubt, that doesn't apply to Hashem. But if the pshat is, there is good and bad, but what does Hashem emphasize? Then indeed, that's something that applies even to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You apply the principle that the reason that they're not given what they intended for the first set of witnesses was that if Hashem intended that the guy should not have been killed, he would have intervened sooner.
That's correct.
That was your basis.
That's what the Ramban says, yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Why not apply that to the first set of witnesses? Why not say, why should this first set of witnesses be given what they intended for the Roseon or whatever? Because if God didn't want to kill him, God would have intervened and something would, and they wouldn't have been allowed to testify, or their testimony would have been overturned right away or whatever. There could be a lot of scenarios. But why apply one principle in one set of witnesses and not to the second set of witnesses?
Well, again, you know, the fact that the first witnesses are discredited as liars, that's a function of their free will. In other words, God is not going to stop. See, God is not going to stop people from lying, because that would be an intervention and an interference with free will. So, God is not going to stop people from lying, but God is going to stop them from being able to carry out their lies. In a negative and destructive way. So when
why not punish the second set of witnesses?
Well, that is a good question. Logically, according to Ramban's analysis, we ought to punish the second witnesses.
Right.
That's correct. The technical reason is they have not been discredited in the so-called statutory form. The statutory form, yet.
It could be a third set.
Oh, yes. This can go on 100 pairs, 100% correct. If a third pair comes and says to the second pair, how can you say the first pair were with me in New York, you were with us in Tel Aviv? Yeah, the same thing is going to happen. That's 100% correct.
Why would they be let free? The only logic I can see where they would be let free is because this can go on ad infinitum.
Well, they're let free unless they're discredited in the statutory form. That's correct. I mean, all I'm saying is...
Statute of limitations, but...
Yeah. Well, as they say, the Ramban says ultimately. The Ramban says ultimately, it's not a totally understandable phenomenon. He's just pointing out one particular aspect. Let me just end with one final thought, because I'm sorry I came a little late today. I just want to say that Shavuos is of course called Zman Matan Torasenu, the season of God giving us the Torah, and people ask the question, why is it not called the time of Kabbalas Torah, saying, of accepting the Torah? And the short answer is,
Matan Torah is a historical event. There was a certain date in history that Hashem gave us the Torah, and we celebrate that on Shavuos. But Kabbalah is our acceptance and our commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that is not something that happened. That is something that happens every single day. We have to accept and re-accept Hashem's Torah. We don't eat breakfast today because I ate it yesterday. We eat it today because today is today. And therefore, it's not possible to talk about a day of Kabbalah Satorah. Every day is Kabbalah Satorah. But we thank Hashem for the Matan Torah, which makes the Kabbalah Satorah possible. Again, Be'ezras Hashem, I hope all of us should be Zocha to truly merit, to appreciate the gift of Matan Torah, and it should result in a renewed Kabbalah Satorah every single day. So a good Yom Tov.